Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic.
Welcome to the National Gallery of Art for today's lecture on the exhibition of Raphael and His Circle. I'm Eric Dinker, Senior Lecturer with the Education Division here at the National Gallery. The occasion for this exhibition is the 500th anniversary of Raphael's death in 1520. In America, the mark of a great collection in the first half of the 20th century was to have a work by Raphael among your other Italian treasures. Fortunately, collectors were able to obtain 14 paintings which now reside in this country, and five of them are here in the National Gallery of Art. We, in addition, have five drawings and a number of drawings by the circle around Raphael and prints after his works. And so here we have the opportunity to really examine his work as part of this commemoration. So we'll start with this work by his teacher, Perugino, Pietro Vannucci. But he came from Perugia, so he was known even in his lifetime as Perugino. Raphael, in fact, had started learning his art from his father, living in Urbino. His father was a painter of a little lesser renown. His father died, however, at the age of 11. And it appears that there were already preparations for him to study with Perugino. Perugino was well known throughout the peninsula. He had done paintings in Florence. He'd done paintings in the area of Tuscany and in Umbria. He had gone as far as Rome, and he had done frescoes on the walls of the Sistine Chapel, 1481, 1482. So he was very much in demand as a great Quattrocento master. The altarpiece that you see in front of you of the crucifixion was done for the Dominican church that was in San Gimignano, a small town in Tuscany, not so far from Florence. It is of the grace and calm and idealization that we expect to see in Raphael's early work, as well as Perugino's. And in fact, this is a painting that, until early in the 20th century, was sometimes attributed to Perugino. As you look at the painting, you can see Christ placed against the cross, which extends almost from the bottom to the top of the altarpiece. On either side, we see St. John or Mary. And then beyond, in the two wings, we can see Mary Magdalene on one side, recognizable by her attributes of the unguent jar and the long red hair. In the other wing, we have St. Jerome, and we can recognize him by the lion, which is in the landscape behind him. Right away, we understand that Perugino was not interested in trying to be historically accurate. Not only are the crosses for the good and bad thief not there, but there are none of the Romans and centurions and none of the group around Christ except for these four figures. And one of these four figures, Jerome, will not live for another 300 years after the event itself. So if we put that historical accuracy aside for a moment, we see that what Perugino has done is to do a very balanced, harmonious scene that takes place not in the Holy Land, but in Umbria. And he has put it in a valley, not on top of Golgotha, not on top of the hill. He's carefully balanced the landscape on one side and the other, as he's balanced the figures on one side and the other. As we look at the figures, they are in quiet contemplation. They are not suffering with the pain of Christ's crucifixion, as Christ himself does not appear to be suffering bodily. He is placed against the crossbeam. But the method of death from crucifixion is, in fact, by the collapsing of the lungs. But here he's not shown bearing down with any weight upon that crossbeam. And he's calm And he radiates that calm to the figures around. And we are asked as onlookers to join in that circle in this same kind of meditation. The entire scheme of the altarpiece can be read by way of that soft fabric, beautifully done, wafting gently in the wind that is around Christ's waist. And so we are invited to become thoughtfully thinking about this idea of the crucifixion and its meaning for us. Well, it's a great painting, and we'll come back to another by Perugino that's in the collection. We are fortunate that we also have this drawing of the Adoration of the Shepherds in the collection. And as you look at this image, you can see the Virgin and St. Joseph on either side of the Christ child, the shepherds there beyond, two angels who have alighted on the ground beyond, the ox and the ass that the New Testament narrative tells us are the first witnesses of the birth of Christ. These figures are used in a variety of different compositions. We associate them most with this painting that is part of an altarpiece, which is now in the Galleria Nazionale dell'Umbria in Umbria in Perugia itself. And you can see those angels, you can see the shepherds and where they've been moved, you can see the Christ child and the very carefully done perspective that creates the illusionistic depth in this painting. And so we come to the earliest of the drawings that are actually by Raphael in the collection. It is not in very good condition, but it is very helpful in allowing us to understand his original ideas and the way the composition of the St. George and the dragon evolved. It is torn and rent, but we can see the careful modulation of tone, creating three-dimensionality in the horse, in the back of the rider, and in that brilliantly conceived dragon down below, made up of an amalgam of a dog head, a serpent's tail, lion's legs, all very carefully naturalistic. This is no doubt partly under the influence of Leonardo da Vinci, because in the first 4 years of the new millennium, from about 1500 to 1504, Raphael is working in Florence. The drawing is in preparation for a painting that we have here in the National Gallery. It tells the story of St. George and the dragon, and now it's been placed into a very naturalistic landscape and a view of a city in the distance. The story of St. George and the dragon comes down to us by way of the Golden Legend by Jacopo Voragine, as well as being told in other places as well. It is of the Christian knight who is riding along and comes to a scene of a serpent and the princess having been sacrificed toward the serpent, but subduing the serpent, not killing the serpent, but subduing the dragon in this case, and taking her girdle, then leading it back by the neck into the city where he will slay the dragon in front of the princess's father and of the community so that they will convert, seeing the great strength that his religion has brought to him. Raphael has done it in a very careful way, very tight brushwork, carefully modulated. You can see the extraordinary effects of light playing across the armor of St. George, how this differs from the bridle and from the saddle, from the horse itself, and from that now much more clearly recognizable image of the dragon. As you look, there are very careful details where Raphael must have been painting with a very small brush, perhaps with just a few hairs, in order to convey a great deal more detail. And here are several details that we can see. And if you look at the detail to the upper left, what you'll find is that he has signed it in gold on the bridle. You can see it says Raffaello. You can also see that if you look below the knee on the armor, that there is actually a garter. And on the garter, it says Oni, H-O-N-I, Oni, which is the beginning of the French phrase, Oni soit qui mal y pense, shamed be he who think of it. And it is the motto of the Royal Order of the Garter. And it is, in fact, probably the reason that the painting was done. Because Raphael, who was in the service of the Duke of Montefeltro, did this painting so that the Duke of Montefeltro could give it as a gift to the emissary of the King of England, who had, in fact, the king had made the Duke a member of the Royal Order of the Garter. St. George being very, very important, the English patron saint, this small work was actually done for Gilbert Talbert, the emissary from the king, and it had a storied history. When it came back to England, eventually it would come into the hands of the Earl of Pembroke, one of Shakespeare's great patrons at the beginning of the 17th century. It passed into the hands, perhaps by trade, into the king's collection, Charles I. After the execution of Charles I, the work would wander through various collections, eventually ending up with the Crozat collection in Paris. And then by Denis Diderot, the great encyclopedist, who recommended to Catherine the Great, the Tsar of Russia, that she obtain the painting. And so it went to Russia at that time in the latter part of the 18th century. It eventually ended up in the Hermitage. And then when the Soviet Union was in need of cash in 1930, it was one of the paintings that was then sold to Andrew Mellon, becoming one of the centerpieces of our Italian Renaissance collection. So the painting has a very distinguished provenance, a very distinguished history, if only paintings could speak. As you look, I want you to notice the landscape detail to the upper right. And I mentioned how tightly painted and smoothly painted this was, and the naturalism of the background. And I want to extend this to the idea that this painting by Hans Memling, done in the 1470s, had come down into Italy. It was in the collection of Bernardo Bembo and then Cardinal Pietro Bembo. It would have been available to be seen, and we think that Raphael probably saw the trees and imitated them for the background of his own painting of St. George. The Memling is also here in the National Gallery's collection, although we have not put it into the special exhibition of Raphael and his circle. Let's return to Perugino for a few moments. This is a Perugino, a typical Renaissance subject. It is an image of the Madonna and Child done around 1500, about the time that Raphael would have been in the studio of Perugino. Raphael, born in 1483, dies in 1520, on the same date, on July 6th. So he's about 17 if he sees this in the studio of Perugino. And as you look at it, there are certain things that we find curious, that are a little disturbing about this image. First of all, we would like to know where the Madonna is seated. Is she on a bench? It's hard to know exactly where she is. And in the background, there's a kind of amorphous landscape that doesn't seem to indicate one particular place or another. Her clothes are a little bit large for her. She holds the Christ child. The Christ child looks off in one direction while she looks down. If there's something important enough for the Christ child to be looking in that direction, why isn't she looking as well? Beyond that, what is the Christ child doing with his arms? Perhaps from a cartoon, it would have made more sense if the Christ child had been holding a grapevine, a symbol of the later idea of the Eucharist. But here, the arm gestures make no particular sense. It's a strong painting as she's wearing the red and blue that are her symbolic colors, but it doesn't really coalesce into a very tight and harmonious composition. If we turn to one of the Raphaels in the collection, we can see that it's quite different. This, the small Cooper Madonna, shows Raphael's easy grace, his harmonious balance, his perfection in the figures. So now we know that the Madonna and Child are seated on a bench, on a parapet, looking out over the countryside. And we sense that even if it didn't exist, we could identify the architecture in the background if it had existed. And then beyond that, look at how carefully integrated the two figures are into a very strong triangle, and they look out in the same direction. Here, the costume of the Madonna actually conforms to the body underneath. It gives us an indication of that anatomy, as opposed to the Perugino, which simply covers the anatomy below. Finally, the figures themselves are idealized figures. They are not simply based on living models, but on the perfection of those models, a hallmark of high Renaissance painting. The painting was done at about the same time as this drawing. The drawing in our collection from the Hammer collection is a work from about 1507. It's been pounced, which is to say that there are holes that have been made in the contours for the Child, for St. John the Baptist kneeling there in the foreground, for the Madonna. And this is a very careful, full-scale drawing that was used in preparation for a famous painting now in the Louvre called The Madonna and Child with St. John the Baptist, but generally called La Belle Jardinière, Madonna and Child done in oil on canvas. So it was in preparation for this painting. From slightly later, we have the 1508 Nicolini Cooper Madonna that is here in the National Gallery's collection. It shows one of the many variations on the theme that Raphael was interested in exploring. Here, the Madonna looks down toward the Christ Child, who in a very childlike gesture reaches over into the edge of the garment while sitting on a pillow on the Madonna's lap. Again, we could make many of the same points about the gracefulness and the careful integration of the figures. Perhaps the most notable of the paintings here by Raphael in the National Gallery of Art's collection is the Alba Madonna, which was done around 1510. And so it shows that he's already been to Rome, he's already making his figures a little bit more robust, and this must be because of engaging with the art of Michelangelo, who he has come to know by way of the Sistine Chapel and by way of other paintings. It is a Madonna of humility. She sits upon the ground, a symbol of her earthly intercession for women and children. She's leaned against a tree stump. On her lap reclines the Christ Child, and he looks down toward St. John the Baptist. He's identifiable as St. John because he has the camel skin on, which he would not receive until later in life, but it is the symbol that helps to identify him. His other attribute is that reed cross, because at a certain point, Christ says to John the Baptist that you are like a reed in the wind, and so the reed cross becomes a symbol for him as well. There is a marvelous sense of three-dimensionality, of modeled form here. We understand that the knee of the Madonna projects toward us, that her shoulder is away from us. They are placed in the context of a landscape with atmospheric perspective that allows us to sense the distance, the blue, the lack of definition, the whitening of the horizon. As you look at these figures, I think one subtlety that often escapes us, as you look at the Madonna, she is not, as the Christ Child is, looking down at St. John the Baptist. Instead, she's looking across at the reed cross, a prefiguration of what will happen to Christ later in his life. As you look at this, this also came from Russian collections. It was, in fact, purchased by Tsar Nicholas I, and it has an interesting history. It is a painting that was transferred. It was originally done on a wooden panel, and the wooden panel began to crack, during its time in St. Petersburg in the 19th century. And so the paint layer, which was done on top of a layer of gesso, which had sealed the panel, the paint layer was carefully removed from the panel being shaved from behind, and then adhered to a canvas using rabbit skin glue. And this is what has preserved the painting for us. We are reticent to do this kind of operation today, but it was done to save the painting in the 19th century and two other paintings as well. We do have other works, including this drawing that was done by Raphael in about 1513, 1514. It is a drawing for two prophets, Habakkuk and Jonah, that was done for the frescoes that were commissioned by Agostino Chigi in 1514 for Santa Maria della Pace, marvelous church with a Bramante cloister not far from Piazza Navona, one of the neglected churches, in a way, in Rome. So here we have that careful study done in pen and ink and wash. And here is the painting that it was done for, and you can see those figures over on the left. And again, notice how robust they are. Think about his actual observations of Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel ceiling, and you'll see that they have become more and more vibrant, more muscular than the early work that we were looking at that had been done in Florence. And here's a close-up with the two figures identified in the fresco as well. We are pleased that we also have this smaller drawing of eight apostles from about the same moment. And this one is done in red chalk that was done over stylus. We know that shortly after Michelangelo had finished the Sistine Chapel ceiling, that Pope Leo X, decided that there should be tapestries along the lower range of the Sistine Chapel, below the frescoes by Signorelli and Perugino and others. And so he commissioned Raphael, who worked on the tapestry cartoons over a period of 4 years, from 1515 to 1519. Those tapestries tell the stories of Saints Peter and Saint Paul. The drawings that were done, the large-scale cartoons, were acquired by Charles I, and 7 of the 10 of those cartoons are regularly on display in the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. At this moment, due to the anniversary celebration, all 10 tapestries that the Vatican owns have been put into the Sistine Chapel in their original locations. Under normal circumstances, they only show 2 or 3 of the tapestries at a time. In this case, for a period of just a few months, they're putting the tapestries in their original location. This drawing was done for the image of Christ handing the keys of the church to Peter. And here is the cartoon from the Victoria and Albert Museum. And you can see that it is for that range of figures from the middle to the right side of the composition. The latest of the paintings that we actually have by Raphael in the National Gallery is his portrait of Bindo Altoviti, done around 1515. He was the banker to the Pope. It is a painting that was probably done for this Florentine banker to send to his wife. He was in Rome, she was in Florence. The very tender gesture of him touching his chest is probably to memorialize his affection and faith toward her, even though he couldn't be present. It is a painting that also has a somewhat storied history, having belonged to King Ludwig I, the King of Bavaria, eventually finding its way into the Alte Pinakothek in Munich, the great art museum that's in Munich, only to be deaccessioned for political reasons in the late 1930s. It was bought by Samuel Kress and was given to the National Gallery. And so that's the 5th of the 5 paintings. But we have more connections to Raphael that we should mention. Raphael did a series of paintings, murals, in the Pope's apartments between 1509 and 1511. Here you can see the Parnassus, the group gathered around Apollo, figures in music and art, great literature, the muses themselves. And we have this as the image that you could see today in the apartments of the Pope's signature. However, how many people actually ever got in to see this painting? Raphael understood that he could have wider circulation, that it would be made available, and his inspiration would be made available to other artists, to writers, to collectors, by working with printmakers. And so in an early stage of working on this composition, he was working with Marc Antonio Raimondi, and they collaborated on 6 different prints. This print is based on a drawing that was done earlier than the painting, rather than the painting itself. So here is what the print looks like, and this is a very strong impression in beautiful condition that's in our collection that has the added virtue of having each of the figures identified in script, handwriting, over their heads, not from the print itself, but done afterward, added as an inscription. And that's very useful to us. So I want you to notice, for instance, those 3 figures beneath the 3 Pudi with their laurel crowns, who are above Dante and Homer and Virgil. And here's the image of Dante and Homer and Virgil together, each of them clearly identified. And I've juxtaposed it with the painting so you can see the number of changes that were made from the drawing to the painting that are not represented in the engravings themselves. The engraving that you see here is the Massacre of the Innocents. This is an instance where Raphael had supplied a drawing, but a drawing specifically to be made into an engraving, not as preparation for a painting. And so this dates to about 1511. It's probably the earliest. The figures are forceful, solid, sculptural. They're inspired not only by contemporary Michelangelo work, but by the Battle of Cascina that Michelangelo had done in the Palazzo Vecchio in Florence. The figures themselves are represented based on 2 ancient sarcophagi, one in the Villa Medici, one in the Villa Pamphili. And as you look at these figures, here is the kind of drawing that Raphael had done in preparation for handing it over to Marc Antonio Raimondi. The background was probably inspired by a cityscape and bridge that are in the Codex Escorialis now, but at the time had wide currency in Rome. And so we have this dynamic scene of figures moving left and right and toward us based on those kinds of nudes that Michelangelo had specialized in. We also have this very fine impression of the engraving of the Judgment of Paris, done probably 1517 to 1519. And as Vasari, the great Renaissance historian, wrote, it was astounding to all of those in Rome. It is of an unequaled pictorial richness in engraving to this point. In fact, he started by taking the copper plate and working the surface over with a pumice stone, thereby creating a nice, even overall tone. And then he created the figures. And here it's the story of the Judgment of Paris being told over there on the left side. That is the seated figure of Paris. Behind Paris is Mercury. The King of the Gods, all the way up in the right-hand corner, has decided not to choose among the 3 most beautiful of the goddesses, not to choose one, neither his wife, closest to Mercury, with the peacock, the symbol of the queen of the gods, of Juno, nor of the figure facing away from us, of Athena slash Minerva, the goddess of war, or the figure of Venus with Cupid in between the two. Instead, Paris will make the judgment, and Paris is bribed by all three to favor them. We know that Athena promises him great strength in war, victory, that Juno promises him great dominion over the lands, but it's Venus who promises him the hand of Helen of Troy, the most beautiful woman, and he chooses love over land or war, and so he reaches out, giving the gift to Venus. It is a very well-told tale. Over there to the right, there are river gods on the ground. You may recognize them as the inspiration some three centuries later for Manet and his image of the Déjeuner sous l'herbe, the figures of his brother, model, and friend seated in the picnic in the grass. It had enormous influence later in the 16th, 17th, all the way up through the 19th century. One of the works that Marc-Antonio Raimondi did from Raphael is called Il Morbetto, The Plague, an engraving from 1512, 1513. Here we have a scene based on Virgil's Aeneid. The epic poem, which was about the foundation of Rome, which described the plague that struck the Trojans in Phrygia, modern-day Turkey, before Aeneas would lead them to Italy. In this design, Raphael depicted the macabre scene of dying humans and animals, and he quotes from the Latin poem, "They relinquish sweet life and drag their sick bodies." And that's what's written on the base of the herm that you see dividing the scene into the nocturnal scene on the left and the daylight scene on the right. It was a scene of compositional daring, figural invention and classical references, but brought together into the new Renaissance ideal point of view. Marc-Antonio's other print after Raphael is of Santa Cecilia, Saint Cecilia, patron saint of music. And I want you to notice that, again, he's working from a drawing that is earlier from the painting. I want you to note very carefully the two saints on either side of the central saint and the figures up above, and how this stands in relationship to the painting itself, which is in the Pinacoteca, the gallery of art in Bologna, Italy. There were, in fact, other people in the workshop, along with Marc-Antonio, other engravers. And in addition, there was a man who was really in charge of marketing, the Bolognese Baviera di Carocci. And Baviero was instrumental in helping to market and make sure that these were put into the public sphere. You can see this image, which is an image by another engraver. It's a little bit stiffer than Marc-Antonio's. It is the Virgin with a fish, and it represents an engraving that is associated with a painting that is today in the great collection of the Prado in Madrid. The reason for this being called the Virgin with a fish is that to the left side of the Virgin and Child enthroned, you see the Archangel Raphael, and he is with Tobit, and this is from the book of Tobit, and that's Tobias with the fish. The Archangel Raphael was very special to Raphael, and we know that it is one of his patron saints, the Archangel Raphael, and it's Raffaello. The book of Tobit was also important at this time, although today it's not included in all versions of the Old Testament. Here is the painting associated with it, again, in the Prado in Madrid. Sometimes the engraver worked after a painting done after a drawing by Raphael, but the painting done by another artist or drawings done by other artists. In this case, the work that you see here is Marc Antonio Raimondi, but it's probably after work that was done by Giulio Romano. And Giulio Romano figures as a very important pupil and then assistant in the workshop of Raphael. And just one other example of a printmaker working in the workshop, one whose identity we're not even sure of. Here, the master of the die from the 1530s, his image of the contest of Apollo and the satyr Marsyas. I mentioned Giulio Romano, born around 1499, lives till 1546, who was apprenticed quite young to Raphael. He did a whole series of drawings, many of them based on Raphael's style. He also takes over the studio at Raphael's death at the age of 37 in 1520. Here is one image of the Archangel Michael defeating the figure of Satan here. This is done in pen and ink as opposed to the image that you see here, which is of the four elements, also by Giulio Romano here, pen and brown ink with brown wash. And we can see earth, wind, fire, and air all represented here. Or here, the pen and brown ink over black chalk. And this is an image of the sacrifice of a goat to Jupiter, also dated to around 1527. 28. So we're rich in the works of the Circle of Raphael, both in the permanent collection and currently on display. Giulio Romano also had artists who engraved after his work, and this is by Agostino de Mussi, also known as Agostino Veneziano from his place of origin. And in this case, the battle with the cutlass, an engraving that was done from 1531. You can see the cutlass, the sword, there in the foreground. And this, too, not only based on the relationship with Raphael, but the understanding of Michelangelo and, again, the great battle scenes that Michelangelo and Leonardo had done in the Palazzo Vecchio in Florence. Another personality of importance in the studio, born just a little later, 1501, was Perino del Vaga. And we have a series of drawings by Perino del Vaga, both preparatory, in this case for a Madonna and Child altarpiece, probably done in the late 1520s, but also simply sheets of studies, figure studies, where Perino del Vaga is trying to come to grips with a sense of movement, of how the body is static at some point and in motion in others. And he covered the sheet on both sides with these small sketches in pen and ink. More specifically, he did this work, Alexander the Great, consecrating the altars to the 12 Olympian gods. This was part of a series of decorations that was done for the Sala Paulina, which was for the Castle San Angelo, one of the residences of the popes. And so we have this very careful drawing that's here in the collection, 1545-47, almost at the point of Perino's death. And here is a detail of the illustrations from the Sala Paulina, and you can see precisely how close it is. Finally, to mention one other artist, to show not only drawings, not only engravings, but that Raphael's influence extends to woodcut and to relief processes. Here it is the work of Ugo da Carpi after Raphael, showing David slaying Goliath. It's a chiaroscuro woodcut, and so we have several blocks that are used and printed successively on the same sheet of paper to indicate the areas of light and shadow, the areas of landscape, and the outlines of the figures as well. We commemorate the 500th anniversary of Raphael's death on April 6th. This will be the 500th anniversary in 2020. Raphael is one of the few figures, like Shakespeare, who was born and died on the same day. We look forward to having the opportunity to talk more about Raphael on this great anniversary year. Hopefully, people will be able to visit one of the number of exhibitions that are going on, both in the United States and in various capitals in Europe. I hope that this has brought some elucidation to the exhibition, and I hope that you'll have the opportunity to see some of those shows. Thank you very much.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.